Chapter 20. Blood for Blood. Gaunt and Baskerville bounded up the Undercroft steps, with Blenner trailing behind them.
"Grey!"
Gaunt yelled. Colonel Grey and his complement of Urdeshi field troops were milling in the lamp-lit hallway, clutching their weapons and looking up in dismay at the sounds of destruction rumbling through the palace above them.
"What is this, my lord?" Grey asked. "Another one," said Gaunt. "Another woe machine, stronger than the first. Is the palace evacuated?"
Grey shook his head.
"We've barely begun," he said. "The power has only just been restored."
Gaunt pushed past him.
"Where's the War Master?"
"I don't know,"
Grey called, hurrying after him.
"I think still on site."
"Damn it, Bartol,"
Gaunt murmured. He looked at Grey.
"And the BT?"
"Taken above," said Grey.
"The Medicae have her."
"It's loose in the palace," said Gaunt.
"Up there, hunting for every target it can find. It'll be seeking out Makaroth, the Saint. That's its purpose."
"How do we stop it, my lord?"
Grey asked. Gaunt was already running up the steps into the main hall of the wing.
"I don't know if we do," he said. "I've seen it."
"It's an abomination," Baskerville said to Grey. He shrugged at the intelligence officer. "This night has been long enough, I think."
"Don't go up there," Blenner wailed from behind them. "Fething hide!"
"The best we can hope is to slow it down," Gaunt told Grey. "By any time we can to get Makaroth and the BT clear."
"And you, sir, surely," said Grey.
"Where did my daughter go?" Gaunt asked.
"Quartered with the Saint," said Grey.
"The chapel. That's where she was taken. All the survivors."
Gaunt looked down the steps at the Urdeshi troops.
"All of you, with me." "You heard the Lord Executor," Baskerville yelled.
They swept into the main hallway, Baskerville forming the Urdeshi into firing lines at Gaunt's heels. Grey and Blenner ran after them. Broken glass littered the floor. Gaunt could smell burning. He could hear the rip and chatter of gunfire, and then the answering wail of a blade on a wetting wheel. Palace staff stumbled past in the opposite direction, fleeing, panicked. Some were injured and bleeding.
"Don't go that way," one man yelled. "Get clear! Get out!"
Gaunt told him as he ran past. Gaunt didn't break stride. Sword in one hand, bolt pistol in the other, he stormed down the long hall towards the source of the uproar. He slowed as he felt the ground beginning to shake. The wall ahead disintegrated in a shower of stone and dust. The woe machine revealed itself, a floating octahedron of grating, sliding blades, locked around an inner glow. It came towards them slowly, shrieking its metal-on-metal cry. Three of the Urdeshi dropped their weapons and fled.
"Line! Line!"
Gaunt yelled.
"Keep that line!"
Baskerville bawled at the Urdeshi. The troops formed up, clattering their weapons to their shoulders, aiming.
"Grenades, ready!"
Gaunt yelled. He heard the troopers slot and lock their underbarrel launchers.
"Hold!"
Gaunt ordered. The woe machine purred closer. The blades at the tip of its form began to spin and open out, blooming like a barbed flower, yellow light shining out of it.
"Dallin!"
Gaunt called out. He hoped there'd be a response, some vestigial flicker of recognition, as there had been before. But he doubted it. And none came. The wailing note simply began to rise into a squeal of wet fingers on glass.
"Commence fire!"
Gaunt ordered. Eyes narrowed, he began to blast at the cloud of whirling blades with his bolt pistol. Either side of him, the Urdeshi opened up, training rapid, accurate fire from their las rifles. Baskerville ripped bursts of full auto from his own rifle, and Grey blazed with his service pistol. Blenner, a few steps behind him, stood empty-handed, gazing at the advancing horror. The sustained fire flickered and danced across the woe machine, the fiery bursts of Gaunt's heavy shots, the flash and spark of the assault weapon barrage. Spinning black blades shattered and were instantly replaced. The woe machine started to spit blades. The razored darts pulsed from its rotating central mass almost silently. An Urdeshi screamed and dropped, a blade skewering his thigh. Another toppled back with a blade transfixing his head. Grey grunted and slammed against the wall, a leaf of black metal embedded in his shoulder. Gaunt felt one slice through the meat of his upper arm as it whizzed past. He put three more bolt rounds into the thing's cycling maw.
"Fall back! Slow!" Gaunt ordered. "Draw it this way! Maintain fire!"
They took a step back, then two, weapons blazing. The woe machine stirred forwards. In unison, all the blades on the front half of its form scissored around to point at them.
It was about to loose them en masse in a pelting hail of knives that would murder the entire squad line. Gaunt saw figures moving behind the woe machine at the far end of the hall. He heard a firm, clear voice calling for squad discipline. Van Voits, Caseda, a damned company of Urdesh heavy infantry, stormtroops, the notorious 17th. Gaunt's microbead crackled.
"Get your asses out of the line of fire, if you please, Lord Executor," Van Voits said. "Cover, now!" Gaunt yelled.
His men scattered, heading for doorways and side rooms. Two of them dragged the trooper with the skewered leg clear. Baskerville had to grab Blenner and almost lift him out of the way. The stormtroops began their blitz. Their methods were not subtle. Hellgun fire, rotator cannons, support lads on man-portable rigs. The heavily armored shock troops advanced down the long hall, demolishing the floor, the ceiling, the plasterwork, the paneling, pinning the woe machine in a killstorm of destruction, a focused barrage that had seen the 17th drive through arch-enemy lines, fortified positions, and even light armor opposition. Churning black blades broke and shattered. The light inside the woe machine flickered, straining. It recoiled, stung hard, and with one rushing clatter, the sound of a thousand swords being drawn at once, it switched the angle of all its blades to face the steadily advancing Urdeshi.
"Heard you needed some support,"
Gaunt heard Van Voits chuckle over the link.
"Appreciated, Lord General," he replied.
"Down payment on my debt, Bram," said Van Voits.
"For Jago!"
"Just kill it, Bartol," said Gaunt.
The woe machine began to spur forwards to meet the oncoming stormtroops. The Urdeshi didn't waver. One step after another, resolute, they marched at it, burning through their ammunition to blow it apart.
"Grenades!" Gaunt called out. "Give it grenades while its focus is drawn!"
Grey's Urdeshi light swung out of their meager cover. Their underbarrel launchers popped with hollow thumps. Crack grenades, arced in with practiced skill, dropped on and around the Heritor's weapon. The blasts came rapidly, an overlapping ripple of hard concussions. Troopers at both ends of the long hall rocked back as the shock waves pummeled them. A cluster of fireballs pounded through the space occupied by the woe machine, choking the hall with surging flames. The woe machine shrieked, its geometric rotations disintegrated, cohesion lost. Blades whirled out of alignment, crossing, colliding, snapping against one another. The pattern broke. Black metal fragments spun out of the firewash like the vanes of a rupturing turbine engine. Stray blades augured into the walls, the floor, and straight up into the ceiling. Most stuck fast, buried like arrows in the stone. The woe machine had become unwound, thrown apart by its own cycling motion.
"Again!" Gaunt yelled.
The Urdeshi around him re-slotted and locked. They raised their weapons to fire and deliver extinction. But the woe machine was not dead. Its circling ribbon of blades, some broken or chipped, rose out of the flames in a strained and elongated figure-eight noose, looping out wide like a thrown lasso. It was enraged. It was hurt. It wanted to flee. It took the shortest route. It went through the stormtroops. Baskerville gazed in horror as the armored men began to drop. Like wooden skittles slammed down in one strike, they rocked and fell, every one of them cut through a dozen times. Blood squirted from deep, scalpel-clean wounds, or poured out between the joints of their ballistic plate. Screaming, its circling blades wide-spaced and overtaxed, the woe machine cut a hole through the end of the long hall and vanished. Gaunt, Baskerville, and some of Grey's Urdeshi hurried through the long stretch of scorched and burning devastation to reach the 17th half of the hall. The stormtroops lay in a carpet of bodies across the wide floor. Few of them were intact. Gaunt stepped over severed limbs and heavy weapons cut cleanly in two. There was blood underfoot, a broad pool of it, and speckles of blood spatter covered the whitewashed walls on either side. Caseda was dead, his left arm split at the wrist and biceps. Half his face was simply missing. Van Voits was still alive when Gaunt reached him. He was on his back, staring at the ceiling. Gaunt could see his wounds were not survivable. Van Voits was aspirating blood, bright red drops that dappled his cheeks and chin like a freckled birthmark. Gaunt knelt down. Bartold. Van Voits blinked, unable to focus. He groaned, blood gurgling in his throat like phlegm.
"Am I dead, Bram?" he mumbled.
"You are, my lord."
"Well, shit,"
Van Voits said, his voice drowning and bubbling.
"That's
payment in full, then. Eh? Blood for blood.
Stay still, Bartol. We'll fetch a chaplain. An Ayatani, or...
I don't need absolution, Gaunt.
Van Voits gurgled. He was still staring blindly at the ceiling.
Made my peace long since. Just loyalty to prove, if late in the day.
You had nothing to prove, Lord General.
Late in the day. Always so dark at this hour. I knew, when it came for me, it would come in the slow hours.
A slackness softened his face and body, the rigidity of pain released by the oblivion. He was gone. The night was wretchedly black. In the small watchroom of the Plaid Parish vapor mill, the night watchman dozed across his console, stirring every now and then to wipe drool from his mouth. A single lamp burned, his only comfort. Rain beat against the room's broad window ports, a blur of streaming water. Nade Oyston appeared at the window, soaked through and out of breath. She yelled at him. He didn't stir. The watchroom was sealed and soundproof against the thunder of the mill when its turbines cycled every 2 hours. She beat on the glass, yelling, hands flat and frantic. Her mouth moved silently. The thick glass just flexed slightly in its frame. The watchman dreamed on. Oyston tried the door, yanking at it, screaming silent profanities. It was locked. She stepped back, defeated, and stared through the windows for a moment at the slumbering man. The rain had washed Rawn's blood off her face. She raised her cut-down riot gun, reached into her bag of shells, and loaded a breaching round. She stepped back, almost vanishing from view. The big flash was silent. The damage was not. The window and the door blew in with a smash like a dozen lead crystal decanters hitting a stone floor. The metal door ruptured in its frame and buckled, its handle and lock torn out in one lump that sailed clear across the room. The watchman hurtled awake, yelping, blinking, and confused. Oyston kicked open the ruined door and stepped in out of the rain. She glared at him.
What?
He stammered.
You have a fething vox somewhere, you idle fething ballbag, she said. Where the feth is it?
The sun had risen 30 minutes ago, though it was still an hour before dawn, half a world away, in Eltath. Orchidel Island, a flat rock of windswept salt scrub and gritty beaches, lay at the southern end of the Faropan archipelago. Few came there. It was a long way from the volcanic systems that fired Udesh's precious forges. Once in a while, agri-boats passed by, heading for the rich offshore blooms in the southern ocean during the late summer algae season. It was not late summer. No boat had passed by in 6 months. The sky was clear, a soft grey-green. No cloud. Visibility out 10 kilometres across the breakwaters. The waves rolled in along the broad shingle beach, hushing on the stones as it had done since the world was born. 10 metres from the shore, the air blistered with a noise like spitting fat. For a few seconds, reality wrenched open and debris crashed out into the shallows. Smoke billowed with it. The scent of burning bone that the wind swiftly carried away. For a moment, the beach rang with the echoes of a distant, shrieking choir. Then space closed again with a sledgehammer thump, an implosion of pressure so fierce the sea beneath withdrew briefly, baring its bed of silt and algae-crusted stones. Then rushed back in, and all was as it had been before. A ragged figure stirred, half swamped in the rolling waves. He crawled and clawed his way up the beach, the waves breaking around him in crossing plumes of foam. Sek paused, panting on his hands and knees, his feet in the water, blood trailing from his wheezing mouth onto the shingle. He was soaked through, engulfed in the pain of his wounds, and maimed by the violence of the translation. His power was reduced to an ember. It had taken everything to break away and escape to this remote and unregarded spot. He crawled on, the shingle crunching and scattering under his hands. Clear of the water, he rose to his knees, reached back, and slowly drew out the power lance that skewered his torso. He gasped with the effort and dropped the weapon on the beach beside him. Out in the breakers, meters from the beach, McColl floated, rocked by the surging waves. He was gazing up at the sky. Daylight. a dawn. He knew he should move, that he had to move. He knew he had come there to finish something. But his memory was vacant. He couldn't remember anything. He had no idea why he was floating on his back in a cold sea, or how he had come to be there. His body was numb from the savage trauma of subspace bilocation, a process few mortals would ever choose to endure, even when armored or cushioned by protective invocations. He let the sea lift him and drop him, over and over, the soothing motion of the breakers. Someone waded past him, staggering and splashing. A shadow blotted out the sky. Milo reached down and clawed at McColl's jacket, searching his pockets. He found the two grenades, one smoke, which he tossed aside, one anti-personnel. He gripped it and waded ashore, teeth clenched, dazed and staggering. The Anarch was just ahead of him, crawling on his hands and knees. No demiurge now, no towering god. An old man in tattered robes, wounded in a dozen places, blood spotting the grey and green pebbles in a trail behind him. Panting, unsteady, Milo reached him. He grabbed Sek by the shoulder and threw him over, rolling him onto his back. The Anarch whined and winced in pain. He looked up at Bryn Milo. Milo stared down. The old man had no face. Small eye sockets gazed up at the Tanith soldier. Beneath them, the rest of his face was a gaping hole. It was fringed with writhing, jointed claws like tiny human fingers. They twitched, holding the gaping mouth wide. Inside the maw was an endless blackness that the morning light could not illuminate. There was nothing in the blackness except the voice. "Enkil Vahakan," it said. The words buzzed at Milo's ears, making him flinch. "You've said enough," Milo whispered. "You've spoken all you have to speak. It's time for silence." He dropped astride the old man's chest, pinning him to the loose shingle. Sek tried to fend him off, beating at him with his bare hands. Milo fended the blows away. He clenched his fist around the grenade, thumbed out the pin, and stuffed his hand into the yawning maw. Sek thrashed, choking. Milo held on, shoving his hand deeper. Sek refused to submit. A surge of neon light lit his empty sockets. He hurled Milo off him. Milo landed badly, rolling, spraying pebbles. The grenade flew out of his hand and bounced across the shingle. He tried to scramble clear. The grenade detonated. It threw up a cone of flame and rained shingle in all directions. Milo was half caught by the blast and flung across the beach, dazed and limp. He tried to rise, his ears ringing, his head spinning. He slumped down on his side. Anakwana Sek rose to his feet slowly. It took effort to get up. He clutched at his wounds, blood dribbling from the damage his foes had inflicted. His maw fingers twitched and fidgeted. He had picked up the power lance. For a moment he leaned on it, panting, using it like a staff to support his weary weight. He stared at the fallen warrior who had almost killed him. Milo wasn't moving. Sek stood up straight. He raised the lance and spun it slowly with both hands in a skilled figure around his body that betrayed the weapon skills of his early years as a Damagawa in the Archon's host, 4 centuries past. He brought the lance to his shoulder, haft up and back behind his head, blade tipped down, hands clasped and spaced for an expert downstrike. This man would die first. He would be the first mark of Sek's vengeance. Others would follow, one by one, then scores, then hundreds, then thousands, then millions. He would make them pay for his defeat. He would make the corpse prophet's minions pay until they wished that he had won at Urdesh, so that suffering would not be multiplied 1,000-fold upon their defiant kind. He thrust. A boot drove into his ribs, knocking him sideways and making him gasp with pain. Another man had come. Then 2 would die first. Sek steadied himself and swung the lance. McColl leapt back. The shingle squirmed under his boots. The lance blade lopped the air. Sek twisted and readdressed, feet braced, looping the lance around to jab. McColl danced clear. He dodged the next swing. He hunched low, a fighting stance, the skerret in his hand. Not straight silver, but it would do. Sek stamped forwards, scything the blade. He had speed and finesse for a wounded old man. He had strength. McColl sidestepped,
As Sek passed him, he slashed with the knife and tore a deep gash along Sek's upper arm. Sek snarled. McColl felt the buzzing swarm into his ears. The Anarch lost the grip of one hand, blood weeping down his arm, but he kept his footing and rotated the lance with frightening skill, spinning it in his right hand. He lunged, then lunged again, forcing McColl backwards up the beach, away from Milo's prone form. He returned to a double grip, blood-wet hands sliding on the lance's haft. He speared at McColl. McColl feinted right, avoiding the lethal strike. He punched in low with his left fist, cracking ribs, and, as Sek hunched, followed with his right and slammed the dagger into the Anarch's chest. Sek flailed backwards. He dropped the lance. The air throbbed with the buzzing whisper of his cries. McColl came on, relentless, stabbing twice more with the serrated blade. Blood stippled his face as he pulled the blade out with each strike, ready to repeat it. Sek fell on his back. Swaying, McColl knelt down to finish the kill. He ran the blade in where the heart should be. Sek shivered and convulsed. His right hand snatched up, scattering pebbles, and clamped around McColl's throat. McColl gasped, his air cut off. The Anarch squeezed. Frail neon light blazed in his dark orbits. Sek would not die. He would not die. Cater Holofernes had been right all along. Blades were never going to be enough. Anarch Sek was a magister. A man like Owen McColl, just a mortal man, was never going to carry enough punch to finish a monster like the Anarch. McColl's vision dimmed. Blood pounded in his head. The strangling grip around his throat tightened. His wet clothes clung to him. He felt a dead weight in his jacket pocket. Unable to break the grip that was killing him, McColl let go of the knife and pulled the anchor mine out of his coat. It was the last one remaining, the one they hadn't used because its anchor pad was broken and refused to grip. McColl had seen what Milo had tried to do. He rammed the anchor mine into Sek's hissing maw. Sek gagged. He let go. McColl scrambled backwards, kicking up stones, retching and gasping. Sek writhed, choking, trying to disgorge the mine from his mouth. He sat up and rolled onto his knees, kneeling for a moment, clawing at his mouth. The mine went off. Foul tissue and liquid sheeted in all directions. McColl sat up, blinking away the blood in his eyes. Gore plastered him and the shingle in a 2-meter radius around the Anarch's body. Sek was still kneeling. His hands had flopped in his lap. He was gone from the shoulders up, smoke fuming from the massive blackened wound and a charred stump of protruding spine. McColl raised his fingers to his lips and blew a goodbye kiss to mock the Sekite salute. The whispering had stopped. Chapter 21. Many, many are the dead. People fled past the chapel door in terror. The sounds of battle and destruction from the floors below were like an approaching nightmare. Hark looked in through the door as people hurried by behind him.
"Clear out!" he yelled. "Come on! It's coming this way! Head to the west exit! There are destriers on the landing field! Move! Now! This is a full evacuation! If you can't make the carriers, get out of the building and hide!"
"You had him," Beltane shouted. "Don't dawdle now."
Most of the retinue and the other survivors who had packed into the chapel had already fled. The remainder were too badly wounded or still too deep in shock to understand what was happening.
"You have to leave," Beltane yelled. "This thing is killing as it goes. It's just blades. Many, many are the dead."
A few of them struggled to their feet and stumbled blankly towards the door. They had already suffered immeasurably that night. It was hard for them to comprehend that anything could be worse. Beltane steered them out.
"Go! Go!" he yelled. "Take her, Bel! Take her!"
Merity shouted, pointing to an old woman from the retinue who was staring numbly at nothing. Beltane ran to the woman and got her on her feet, gently guiding her by the shoulder and the hand.
"You too, Mamchas," he said. "We're coming," Merity called back.
Two stretcher cases remained, unconscious and too injured to walk even if they'd been awake. Merity and Fezekiel crossed to them as Beltane led the old woman out.
"We can't carry both," Merity said. "Then this one first," said Fezekiel. "We'll come back for the other one."
Merity nodded.
"Come back? That's a prospect. All right, take that end."
"I can help," said Merin.
They looked at him. He'd come from nowhere. His face was sallow with fear.
"Get some help then, Captain," said Fezekiel. "Another bearer, anyone, and we can carry them both."
"No," said Merin. "You take that one. I'll shoulder lift the other. There's no time to be lost.
All right, said Fazekio, turning to grip the stretcher's handles. I appreciate your help. Merrin nodded.
Help, he muttered. That's right. A night like this, it's time to help yourself.
What?
Fazekio snapped. Merrin ran his straight silver into Fazekio's back. She gasped and fell backwards as the blade came out again. Merity stared at Merrin.
Oh, Feth, she said.
Beltane gently escorted the old woman along the panelled hall, passing the wardroom and then the chamber door where Hark stood with Lakshima and Oban.
Get her clear, Bell, said Hark.
I will, sir.
Everybody out?
Almost.
Then get yourself out. We'll do the rest.
Beltane nodded and hurried on his way. Hark turned to his companions.
How will we do the rest, do you suggest?
Oban asked. Hark grunted. He pushed past them and entered the chamber. The Medicaid staff had been ordered out, but Kurth still tended the saint. Zwile sat nearby, hands clasped, murmuring a prayer. The eagle perched on the back of a chair.
The Feth's that doing in here? Hark asked.
Not high on my list of priorities, replied Kurth,
without looking up from her work.
The thing's coming, Anna, he said. Coming right for us. We have to move her.
Well, we can't, said Kurth. She's barely hanging on. I believe she's healing her psychic wounds, or something is, but it's slow, and it's uncertain. If we move her, she will die.
Then we have to leave her, said Hark.
Zwile shot him a toxic look.
Absolutely not, said Kurth. I'll stay with her.
Me too, said the old priest.
Hark sighed.
I bloody knew you'd say that, he said.
You're not going either, are you?
Asked Zwile.
No,
Hark admitted. He turned back to the doorway.
We make a stand here, he said.
I was already planning to,
rasped Oban. She had a las rifle in her hands. Hark nodded. He pulled out his holdout gun.
We make a stand with that?
Lakshima asked, looking at the small weapon dubiously.
It's not about size, said Hark.
No, I'm lying. Right now a tank would be good. I feel you've got something effective up your sleeve, Inquisitor, and I don't mean that metaphorically.
Lakshima raised her right wrist. The lamplight glittered off her ornate bangle.
Anti-mat disruptor, she said. Xenos manufacture. Very small. But size isn't everything, as you say. I used to believe these could stop anything. But I burned out the other one on the first machine.
It's better than nothing, said Hark.
They took up station in the doorway. The wailing swish of blades was coming closer. Merity backed away from Merrin very slowly. The candles in the chapel flickered.
What did you tell her, eh?
He hissed. He glanced down at Fazekio.
Don't worry, I know. I'm a ghost. I read lips for a living.
What the hell are you doing?
Asked Merity.
Taking advantage of an opportunity, Merrin replied. You heard Bell. Many, many are the dead, like the old song goes. All cut up to ribbons. Deaths everywhere. Who knows what the final body count will be? Who knows what dirty little secrets will die with the dead tonight?
Merrin. Flynn.
Don't Flynn me, he said. You've got me good. But some secrets are meant to stay secrets, you see.
I think you might have gone fething mad, Captain,
Merity said.
I think I'm perfectly sane, he replied. I'll take my chances. I'm quick on my feet. A little straight silver, and my secret's safe. I'll be gone, out there, in Adestria, running clear. What are two more corpses in a bloodbath like this?
He stepped closer. She backed up. He smiled. Her eyes darted around. Ralph's carbine lay on a cot nearby. He saw where she had looked.
Don't even, he said.
Merity faked right, then darted left for the cot. Merrin lunged at her, missing by a slim margin. Merity forward rolled across the cot, just as she had been taught in the relentless basic training drills aboard the Armaduke, back when she'd been a novice trooper called Felix Chass. She came up, gripping the carbine. She aimed it at him with a grin. Then her face fell. Merrin was aiming back at her. He'd snatched up Fazekiel's pistol from the Medicaid cart.
Drop the carbine, he said. I'd rather do this quietly. People might question gunshot wounds.
Let them question, said Merity.
You bastard.
Merrin fired. The gun clacked. Empty.
I don't think I can protect you again.
He remembered Fazekiel saying that, down in the Undercroft. The stupid bitch had meant she'd used up all her ammo. He threw himself at Merity, the war knife slicing in. The carbine bucked in her hands. The muzzle flare was intensely bright in the gloomy chapel. Rapid-fire shots tore into Merrin, puncturing his torso 6 times and shredding off his left arm at the elbow. The final 2 went into his face, destroying his look of indignant surprise.
"Gunfire," murmured Hark.
"Lass,"
agreed Urban.
"It was close," said Hark. "Sounded close. Thrown, it must be nearby now."
He glanced back at Kurth and Zweil, vigilant at the Saint's side. He smelled very faintly the scent of Islambine. He put it down to his frantic imagination, but the idea reassured him.
"I can hear it wailing," said Lakshima.
"I told you it was close," said Hark.
"Very close," the Inquisitor replied. "So why can't we see it?"
"What are you showing me?" asked Marshal Tsara above the din of a war room seething with activity as it tried to rebuild its strategic overview of the Eltath zone.
"Picked capture," replied Biota. "It has just come in. Vox Operation received it 2 minutes ago, so I brought it to you directly."
"What is it?" she asked. She stared at the on-screen image. It looked like a fuzzy map of an island. Graphic enhancement had compensated for the nocturnal view.
"Well, it could be a breakthrough," said Biota.
"It is an island, sir," snapped Zara. "An island in a sea. My concern is the Eltath Theatre. Bring me data on that."
"Please look," said Biota. "These images were captured by the battleship Naiad Antitor during a routine orbital sweep 10 minutes ago. That's Coltrice Island, a cone atoll west of the Eltath Peninsula, at the southern end of the Sadime Archipelago. It's a dead volcano, hollow inside, used in ages past as an agri-town and safe harbour, thus sometimes called the Fastness."
"Your insistence on detail bored me yesterday, and it bores me today, tactician," Zara warned. She kept glancing at the station chiefs, who were holding signals in the air. "I'm coming," she cried.
"Observe here," said Biota,
enlarging the image with his fingertip and enhancing the thermal contrast.
"On the last routine sweep, 20 hours ago, the island was cold. No heat read. No human activity. Look at it now, Marshal. We think it was cloaked by some form of masking field or cloak device, which has recently failed."
"This is heat?" asked Zara, peering in.
"Indeed. A venting plume."
"Volcanic?"
"The cone is extinct."
"So what?"
"We think it's a ship fire, ma'am," Biota said. "An engine fire or significant internal heat damage."
"A ship," said Zara. She frowned and peered again.
"Quiet!"
she yelled over her shoulder at the war room bustle. The noise subsided.
"A ship, tactician?" she asked.
"Yes," said Biota. "If I enlarge again, like so, you'll see the shadow here. I'll enhance contrast. A shadow, under the projection of the cone lip. That's a shift ship of considerable tonnage. A fast cruiser."
"Is it one of ours?" she asked.
"We're waiting for confirmation," he replied. "A damaged vessel might have run to cover there and been unable to signal its position. But...
A hand reached in past them and enlarged a spectrographic code in the sidebar of the main image.
"That plume is venting high levels of iridium matroxon," said Makaroth.
"My lord," said Zara, pulling herself upright.
"You are quite correct, my lord," said Biota. "That's fuel burning," said Makaroth.
"Our ships burn a standard antium baronel intermix. That's an enemy ship, and it's been hiding as close to Eltath as it can get."
"Is it him?" Zara asked.
"We've searched for the bastard everywhere," said Makaroth, "and he's cowering on our very doorstep."
"Marshal?"
"My great lord?"
"Link me to the fleet," said Makaroth. "I wish to call in an annihilation strike in the next 30 minutes and wipe that island off the face of Urdesh."
Merity lifted Fezekiel up and wiped the blood off her face and out of her mouth.
"Luna! Luna!"
Fezekiel blinked weakly.
"That really hurts," she whispered.
They heard the wailing rush of blades nearby. It was very close.
"Oh, shit," whispered Merity. "It heard us. It heard the shots. It's coming."
"Leave me," said Fezekiel.
"Balls, I will,"
Merity replied. She tried to hoist Fezekiel up, but the woman had blacked out and become a dead weight.
"Come, fething on,"
Merity snarled.
"I came looking for you,"
said a voice behind her. Merity looked around in surprise. It was Dalin.
"Oh, thank Thrawn," she said. "Please help me quickly. We don't have much time."
"Papa's dead,"
Dallin said. Merity laid Fezekiel back down gently and rose to face Dallin. His face was blank with shock. He appeared to be bleeding. She couldn't tell where he had been wounded, but his hands were dripping with blood. Drips spotted the floor around his feet.
"Oh, Dal," she said. "Gol, he's dead."
"Papa's gone," he said.
"We have to go, Dallin,"
she said, stepping towards him.
"There's nowhere to go," he said. "I don't understand. I don't understand any part of this. It's all just chaos in my head." "I think you're in shock, Dallin," she said. "You've been through too much. If Gol is... and Yonsi..."
"She was my sister," said Dallin.
"I know. You believed that for so long. We all..."
"She was my sister," he repeated.
"Let's go, all right? Dallin, let's go. You're not feeling yourself."
"I'm not myself," he said.
"Of course you aren't."
"I came to find you," he said, "because I don't understand anything. I don't know anymore. Except I know I trust you. I like you."
"I like you too,"
Merity said.
"I think I might have been in love with you."
"Oh," she said. She smiled.
"Might have been?"
He shrugged, expressionless.
"I want to understand," he said. "And you know."
"Know what?"
"You know what it's like,"
he said.
"To hide yourself. To hide your real self. Hide it inside and look like something else."
"That?" she said.
"Oh, that was just a game. It was childish, and I regret it."
"Childish," Dallin echoed. "Everything's childish. Just games. Games that Papa made us play." Merity turned to Fezekiel. Dallin grabbed her arm. His grip was strangely hard.
"Ow,"
she said in surprise.
"Let me go, Dallin."
He didn't.
"That hurts. Please let me go."
He released his grip.
"I don't want to hurt you," he said. "I don't want to hurt anyone. But Papa's dead, and I miss his voice. He'd tell me what to do. He'd explain it all to me. Some things, they can't be explained,"
Merity said.
"Life is cruel and hard. It's unfair. You just do what you can."
He thought for a moment. "The difference," he said. "The difference between you and me. You knew what you were hiding. You did it on purpose.
I never knew. I never knew at all. I never knew what I was hiding." "I don't understand, Dallin," she said.
"Papa's dead," he said. "He can't explain it. I thought you could, but you can't either." He raised his left hand. It was soaked in blood. The sword sliced through him from behind. Dallin lurched, ripped almost in two. His face remained impassive. Gaunt hacked again, driving the sword of Hieronymo Sondar through the husk of Dallin's body. He struck repeatedly and without mercy until the ghost was mangled on the floor. Merity screamed.
"Oh, Thrawn, stop! Stop! What the feth are you doing? What the feth are you doing?"
"Get back," said Gaunt. "Get well back." He was vulnerable for a minute. He wanted to talk, so his defenses were down.
"You killed him," she yelled. "You fething sliced him to ribbons."
"Look," Gaunt hissed. She looked. There was no blood, except the blood that stained Dallin's hands. The deep cuts in his body revealed nothing but odd, dark strips, like thin metal leaves sheaved together. The ends of his fingers on both hands were split, as if they'd ruptured from within. Gleaming points, like the tips of scissor blades, protruded from the frayed skin. His eyes were still open. A dull yellow light, like a pulse of neon, flickered inside his severed torso.
"Oh, Thrawn,"
Merity whispered. "Inquisitor," Gaunt called. Lakshima stepped into the chapel, followed by Hark and Baskerville. Baskerville gently drew Merity aside. She gazed at Dallin in utter bafflement.
"That was a risk, my lord," said Lakshima.
"A chance," Gaunt replied. His guard was down. "Please, while he is still dormant, the self-repair is rapid and alarming." Lakshima nodded. She aimed her right hand, arm outstretched.
"Look away,"
she said. The disruptor made a high-pitched squeal,
A steady, pencil-thin beam of blinding mauve energy lanced from her wrist and scored into Dallin Creed's body. She kept it burning for almost a minute, until there was nothing left but cinders and flakes of ash, like the soot in an empty grate. Chapter 22. The Victory.
"Where were you hit?"
asked Mabon.
"Doesn't matter," said Rorn.
"You're hit?" asked Val.
"I said it doesn't matter," said Rorn.
They struggled on through the rain, past the silent rock-crete blocks of the mill.
"It does," said Mabon. "You can barely walk. Let me see."
"Get off me," said Rorn.
"Oh, Feth Eli," said Val. "Look at you. I don't know how you're standing. Why didn't you say?"
"Because it's something that happened, and there's nothing we can do about it," said Rorn.
He looked at them. His face was pale. He had to lean on the wall just to stay upright.
"You can't even lift that gun," said Val quietly.
"I can if I need to."
"You know they can smell the blood," said Mabon.
"I do now," said Rorn.
"Doesn't matter,"
said Mabon.
"They'd have our scent anyway. Sweat, pheromones, fear. But blood is always strongest."
"We just need to keep moving and lay low," said Rorn. "That's all. Oyston will come through. I know she will."
He tried to straighten up, but he couldn't.
"And if we have to fight?" asked Val.
Rorn held out the las rifle to Mabon.
"You take it," he said.
"No,"
said Mabon.
"For Feth's sake," Rorn growled.
"I won't fight any more, Rorn," said Mabon. "I've fought for too many sides, too many causes. None of them have made sense to me. So rather than make an oath to others, I made one to myself. I would fight no more. It's the only pledge I think I can keep."
"Pardon me, Fagoth," said Rorn. "You're hardly one to give a lecture on principles, you fething traitor."
Mabon looked away.
"But you fought for us," said Val. "In the end, you came to us. Cross the lines." "Not to fight," said Mabon, "even if you had let me."
"You came to help us win," said Val, "to help us stop the war. That's the same thing."
"No, that was very different," said Mabon.
"Well, I've seen some things," said Rorn,
grimacing.
"Now I've met the only fething pacifist objector in this whole fething galaxy."
Val suddenly signalled. Movement. They hurried in against the flank of a workshed.
"Something,"
Val whispered. An object hit the wall behind them and bounced onto the floor. The grenade wobbled like an egg as it rolled. Val threw himself at Mabon, driving him aside. Rorn tried to dive the other way. The blast made a dull and hollow crump in the driving rain. Rorn found himself lying on his side, his cheek against the wet ground. He couldn't move. It had been almost an hour since he'd taken the hit in the yard of Camp Xenos. He'd been bleeding ever since, and he knew the loss was severe. He was too weak. Too weak for anything. His will was strong, but his body had given up. He felt himself slipping into the dark place he'd spent his life fighting to avoid. Mabon stirred and got to his feet. Small flecks of shrapnel had cut his face. Rorn was down, curled on his side to Mabon's left. Val lay to his right. The sergeant had shielded Mabon with his own body. Mabon saw the bloody shrapnel wounds and scorched clothes on Val's back and legs. He was face down and still breathing, but the blast had thrown him into the wall and rendered him unconscious. Mabon saw the two figures approaching out of the rain. They were walking side by side, with no sense of haste. One carried a las rifle, the other was empty-handed. Mabon sighed. He reached over and picked up Val's weapon, then stepped out to meet them. Rorn saw the three figures. He couldn't speak. He saw them side on, the world turned on its edge. He tried to move. No part of his body responded. But he could hear them speak. Like Owen McColl, he hadn't survived a year on Geryon without learning the enemy tongue. Mabon faced the two Kimura, rain streaming down his face. He held the weapon low, down at his hip, covering them.
"Hadrol. Jagar."
"Fagoth,"
said Hadrol.
"No more grenades?"
Mabon asked. Hadrol shrugged, his hands empty.
"Resources are limited," he said.
His eyes flashed yellow, and his talons crackled as they elongated into hooks.
"But we don't need munitions." "You'd fight us now?"
asked Jagar, his rifle raised.
"I'd rather not," said Mabon. "I've had enough. If it had been down to me,
I would have submitted to you at the very start, but you threatened these men, and I will not let you kill them.
What are they to you?
Jaegar sneered.
Nothing, said Mappin. Not even friends. But they have protected me with their lives. I owe them as much. Let them live, and I'll come with you.
All right, said Hadrel.
You lie so easily, Hadrel, said Mappin.
I know, Hadrel replied. But you know lies better than I do.
He took a step forwards. Mappin raised Val's rifle in a quick warning gesture, adjusting the underbarrel tube.
No closer, he said. You have a rifle, and you have claws. I have a grenade tube. The reworked are blessed, and they are mighty. But this will make a mess of you both at close range.
Indeed,
grinned Jaegar.
If it was working.
He eyed Mabin's gun.
I can see from here the mechanism is jammed.
Mabin was well aware of that. The launcher tube had been buckled when the blast slammed it against the wall. He'd noticed that the moment he'd picked it up.
Well, he said, a bluff might have worked.
He tossed the rifle aside.
I wanted to know why, said Hadrel.
All of us did, said Jaegar. Why did you turn, Mabin?
Hadrel asked. Mabin laughed.
I am tired of explaining. I don't owe you any answer. Not you or anyone. I am done with war.
But you sided with them, said Hadrel.
For the stones, nothing more, said Mabin.
But they are everything, said Hadrel. The Anarch has told us so. Enkil Vech, a certain victory, and you brought it to them.
The Eagle Stone Key is an abomination, said Mabin. You know what it does. I am done with war, and it is the greatest monstrosity war has built. I cannot stop this crusade, this endless bloodshed. But I thought perhaps I could stop that.
By giving it to them?
Asked Jaegar.
To the Corpse Prophet's chieftains? How is that not taking sides?
The Anarch knows what the key does, said Mappin. He knows where to take it and how it works. But the men of the throne, they know nothing, except that the key is valuable and must be kept from you. If they possessed it, they would guard it, remove it from the Sabbat worlds, keep it from you, so that it could never be used.
They would learn its secrets, said Hadrel.
I doubt it. A thing that old, that Vergoth. They would never puzzle it out.
He looked at them both.
They would not know how to use it, but they could keep it safe, so Sek could never use it.
The great Magir will have the key by dawn, said Jaegar. When his voice next speaks, it will be to tell us that the key is recovered, said Hadrel. Korod has been sent.
Mabin sagged.
Then it was all for nothing, he murmured.
The rain pattered around them.
It was all for victory, said Hadrel. That was a thing you once rejoiced in. Why did that change?
It changed because I was good at it, said Mabin. As Sirdar, as Damagawa, as Itagawa, I rose and I conquered. I burned worlds. I was a champion of the Sekhite host, inculcated to the truths of the Anarch.
He looked down at the ground and watched the raindrops dance around his feet.
He was pleased with my service, so pleased to turn a man from one side and make him its unflinching foe. So he rewarded me. He bestowed upon me the highest honor, as a favor for my service.
A blessing, said Jaegar.
A curse, said Mappin. It let me see the truth, the deranged hell of the Immaterium, and those gods which dwell within it. I saw them all. I saw myself. I saw how he had changed me. I saw what he had made me. It was enough. I turned my back on war forever.
He looked at them, levelly.
Walk away, he said. This does not have to happen.
We will not, said Hadrel. You are Fagoth, and you will die. You and those who shelter you.
Mabin exhaled. A long, slow breath.
I will not let you harm them, even if that means breaking my oath. I've broken many, so I suppose that doesn't matter in the end. Last chance, Sirdar Magir. Walk away, and I'll let you live.
Jaegar fired. The las rounds tore into Mabon's side and rocked him backwards. He ploughed forwards anyway, rushing into the hail of shots, flinching with each impact. He tore the rifle from Jaegar's hands and sent the Kimura flying with a fist. As Hadrel came at him, Mabon swung and smashed the rifle across Hadrel's face. Jaegar bounded at him. Mabon tossed the broken rifle away and met Jaegar's attack with a punch that cracked teeth. Jaegar tumbled back. Mabon lunged after him. The Faegoth's clothing was torn, shredded by the lasfire. The flesh of his chest bubbled and dripped with yellow gore. Neon heat welled in his tired, empty eyes. His fingers bulged. Bones snapped. The flesh broke and sprouted talons. He smashed Jaegar down with a blow that snapped the Kimura's head aside and sprayed yellow gore into the air. Hadrel smashed into him, raking claws deep into Mabon's chest and back. Yellow plasma gushed from the wounds. Mabon grappled with Hadrel, strength to strength, limbs locked. He forced the Sirdar backwards, their arms entangled. Jaegar crashed into them, gouging his claws and teeth into Mabon's flank. Mabon swung, hurling Hadrel away. He smacked Jaegar aside with a backhand, then ripped his talons through the Kimura's throat. Jaegar fell to his knees, clutching at the frothing yellow liquid pouring from his opened neck. Mabon grabbed his head with both hands, twisted, and wrenched it off. Jaegar's corpse fell forward. Mabon staggered, mauled and bleeding. He swayed. Hadrel was on his feet again.
"You were always the best of us, Mabon," he hissed. "So very blessed." "I never asked for it," said Mabon. He spat yellow blood, his eyes neon fire. "I never wanted it, but he blessed me anyway."
They clashed like charging bulls, talons tearing and rending, and tore away each other's flesh with the fury of demons. His vision graying back to nothing, Rorn watched as they both fell in the rain, tangled and torn apart, locked together in a final embrace. Neither of them rose again. His vision failed. When it returned, for a brief moment, the cold of eternity was in his bones. He glimpsed lights, dazzlingly bright in the rain, pulsing green and red. He heard the scream of lifter jets. He heard Oyston's voice calling his name, calling him back. And that was all.